was asked by
Conan to just welcome Rios and on behalf of Conan, the board, and our Sangha. We welcome you and are grateful for your presence today. Ryuzen is the resident priest at One Pine Hall Zen Center in Seattle, Washington, and is a student of Suzuki Hoitsu Roshi. And we're very glad to have you here with us.
Thank you very much. And thank you for your generosity in letting me teach on your lecture day. So, welcome. And thank you for welcoming me. It's nice to see a little sunshine during the
keynote. Yeah. That's for a second.
So I thought, you know, with the season being upon us, you know, the holiday season, Christmas season, I'd like to talk a little bit about the bodhisattvas that are everywhere. And this story comes from one of the elders in our tradition, in our community here in the United States. So there is a Tibetan lama who was living in Oakland and was supposed to be have a deep grasp and understanding of the Dharma. And so some of the senior priests from the San Francisco Zen Center had wanted to go and meet him and pay their respects. And so they, you know, made an appointment, and on the appointed day, they drove from San Francisco over to Oakland and went to his apartment, and, you know, he ushered them in, and you know, it's a typical modern apartment and of that time, and had a fireplace in the apartment, and there on the mantle, you know, was a statue of Chinrezi or Kuan Yin for us, and you know, some of the other manifestations of the Dharma, you know, Green Tara, and pictures of his teacher. And there was a little statue of Santa Claus. And these, you know, priests from San Francisco were like, you know, I don't think you understand. This is a, you know, a fictional, you know, storybook character, you know, that we celebrate, you know, with the story of Christmas, you know, St. Nicholas. Oh, no, no, this is a great, great bodhisattva. No, no, you know, it's Santa Claus. And then he went on to, you know, this lama highlighted, you know, the virtues that we know of Santa Claus, you know, a sense of generosity and his giving presents to children, you know, and his miracle powers of being able to travel the world in one night. And so, of course, what else could it be but a bodhisattva? And I was really, you know, before I heard this story, you know, I grew up here in the United States and was, you know, went to Sunday school and was kind of indoctrinated into the normal Judeo-Christian values that most of us grew up with here. And in that process of taking on the faith of Buddhism, you know, I'd kind of distanced myself from those icons of, you know, the traditions that we have here in the United States. And so this story had a profound effect on me, and which is why I share it with you, bodhisattvas can be found everywhere, and they're not, you know, mystic, mysterious folks living on the mountaintops in faraway countries. You know, that they are here in our own, you know, cultural mythology, you know, examples of Dharma, you know, the Dharma of generosity, the Dharma like Fudomyo Sama, you know, this, you may know him, he's this guardian of the Dharma. He has this terrible angry scowl, and it's colored red and has flames coming out of him, and he's immovable wisdom, you know, fearlessness. But we have fearless icons in our own tradition, you know, the gunslingers of the West, or, you know, the people that stood and in the face of great oppression, like David and Goliath. You know, David had fearlessness. He was able to stand in the face of, you know, certain death and express his faith. And so I offer this to you, this story to you, as an invitation to find those bodhisattvas in your own life. You know, whether they're stories of, you know, mythological characters, or they're stories of, you know, Mahatma Gandhi or Martin Luther King, or, you know, the family of the young man in Ferguson who, you know, asks for not to be violent in their son's name, you know, your grandchildren, or, you know, their ability to bring joy spontaneously to our lives. So, Have you found people or stories that have been important for you in terms of bringing the Dharma more clear into your lives? That's kind of my Dharma talk, so I don't talk a lot.
I immediately thought of Rosa Parks.
Oh, yes.
Who wouldn't get off the bus.
Yeah.
Started the whole civil rights
movement. Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. I've created in my own imagery what I call my board, and sitting around the board table are all of the teachers that I've met, either physically or through readings, you know, spiritual, you know,
yeah,
people who are. Who have influenced me, guided me, and they're my round table. I kind of, as a kid, I was in, you know, really interested in King Arthur, the round
yes.
table. So I've created a table, and they include friends, mm-hmm. friends of mine, people that I've worked with, that hold, that have inspired me, have modeled for me the kinds of things that I would like to aspire to be. So it's
yeah.
kind of a it's a whole collage of bodhisattvas that, you know, that I can turn to, you
mm-hmm.
know, at times for inspiration.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
I have the guy I thought of is I work at the newspaper here, and I'm just about to leave. There's a downsizing, and newspapers all over the country are downsizing. And there's a guy, just, you might remember Greg Pearson. I don't know if he was there when you were there.
Reporter?
No, a copy editor. But he's a really skillful editor. I think he's in his late 50s. And so they were, they offered a buyout so that you could, you could have some salary for, you know, depending on how long you served and so forth. And he has been the president of the union,
mm.
And he just, I felt like he offered himself, he took the buyout, And I'm not sure at how you know how safe that is for him financially. But his wife is has complained that he worked at nights for years, and he and he was concerned about other people who you know, what will happen to other people if he didn't take the buyout. There would be layoffs and.
So some sense of self-sacrifice.
He's very patient. If someone has an issue, he's very patient with his time, and he's works really hard to figure out the issue. Mm-hmm. So yeah, but this seemed like a big sacrifice, but one he did happily. Mm-hmm. And so, I ended up doing it too, but not quite so
happily.
But anyway, that's who I thought of. He's a really decent guy. So.
It's amazing how people touch us.
Yeah.
You know, in their whether they know it or not, you know, just that they.
Right.
And I think we all have moments of bodhisattva in us, do you know what I mean? Where each one of us steps up and has a moment, has an experience of fearlessness or, you know, doing what's right despite the circumstances or despite the risks. So, I mean, I could name so many people, especially, you know, those that are lovers of nature and stand up for the non-human beings. Mm-hmm. John Muir and Beatrix Potter, who started the Nature Conservancy, and Thoreau, and you know, all the usual, Leopold. But each one of us does it in our own way, in our own time, in those moments, I think. Mm-hmm. And I'm grateful for that. For the bodhisattva in me and in each one of us.
I remember when I was here, I've run the gamut through religions. Started out actually as a Baptist child, you know. Then I left home and I went to Philadelphia, and I was around a lot of jazz musicians who preferred Islam as their religion, so I became a Muslim. And then I came home back to Wisconsin, and I got involved with the Pentecostal church. And then I got tired of that. So I was just looking through the telephone book one day on the religions. And I see Buddhists. So I called their news and said, and told him to answer the phone. And so he asked him what Buddhism was about. He said, "You want to come by?" I said, "Yeah." So I came here, this little bitty man. And so he says, "Why are you interested in Buddhism?" I said, "I don't know. I said, I just want to be happy." So he says, "I can't promise you happiness." He said, "All I can offer you is the Zappu." And so it hasn't always been that, but I know that I'm better off for being here. And that it's the best thing that's ever happened to me, despite all the ups and downs.
Thank you.
I don't wish to sound self-promoting, but when you had mentioned looking for bodhisattvas in other places and started explaining it, I immediately thought of my wife and some of the reasons why I was attracted to her. She works as a CNA, and she has repetitively stepped up and shown extreme compassion and attempts to find justice for the people that she works for. She's taken on the company that she's worked for. She's lost jobs because she places all the clients first, who she says this is basically people that the rest of the world is throwing away. And she's gotten into physical altercations with a lot of the clients. She works with mentally disabled people. Mm-hmm. And the thing that I guess makes this so relatable to being a bodhisattva is that she does all of this, and it's frustrating for her. It's certainly a trial every day, but she does it because she wants to make things better for these clients, and she genuinely wants to give everything she can to her job. She's a brilliant person, could easily go on to be a nurse, but says that, well, if you do that, you get removed from being face-to-face with these clients. She says, my place is down here with everybody on the ground level. Mm-hmm. And that's genuinely an admirable character or quality about her that led me to her in the first place, and wanted, you know, I wanted to have her in my life because of those things, and she teaches me those things and what that means every day.
Mm. Very fortunate.
Is there any kind of a distinction that you can point to that would help us to know easier that a bodhisattva is present?
Good question. The experiences that I have, which may not be, may be dreams, my own dream, but those people that bring us back to this moment, you know, don't take us away or don't seduce us or repulse us, but who bring us to this moment in their actions. Hmm. Whether it's, you know, a poet that we read, or a person we see on the street, or you know, our partner, it is in those moments that we come back to now. Hmm. Here and now. And I think I those are times where I think of bodhisattva. Usually I don't notice it in the moment, because I like it's just now here, but later I think, oh wow, that was a kind of sudden, you know, coming here. What's your experience?
I'm trying to do in writers. Mm. I think Red Pine.
Oh yes, yeah.
Is exemplary. But now I'm looking at Shohaku. Shohaku is just tearing me apart. You know, he just makes you want to live this life. Mm. Mm. Even though, you know, it's controversy in my mind. That's all I'm saying, in my mind. Mm-hmm. about some of the things he says.
Mm-hmm.
And Ray Pine says too. I told you I called him.
Yeah.
And you know, you caught me in all the years I've been writing. I got a question I want to ask you. I can't figure it out for myself. But, you know, it's just wonderful to have a good teacher.
Yeah.
You know, someone you can go to and ask anything.
Mm-hmm.
When those in his first year, almost up to the year, you could ask Tozin anything. like today, I asked a question, like say yes to ask it, because then I would show up the next day. Yeah, just to ask a question, now I ain't here. Not here. I got the answer for her. Why don't you come? I don't know, but he would answer.
Mm,
yeah.
Any question you had.
And he might do it the following week.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
He was just unbelievable up until the end.
The Norton, the curtain over the kitchen door, has two people on it. That's Kanzan and Jitoku. And they're good friends,
mm-hmm.
right? They're part of our Zen mythology. They're actual people, and they were poets in China, the 6th century, I believe. And they, one, he's the one with the scroll. His name is Kanzan, or Cold Mountain. And you might, I don't know if in the library there's any poems of Cold Mountain, but he was a wanderer. He would go up into the hills behind the temple and just wander around and write poetry and get lost in the cloud-shrouded peaks and trails and valleys in the mountain. And Jitoku is often painted with a broom or a bamboo rake, but they look like brooms for sweeping leaves and such. And Jitoku would often go up into the mountains and bring Kanzan back down, you know, because he would get lost in his,
his wanderings.
Wanderings, yes. Mm-hmm. And that kind of friendship, I think, is profound and is a critical aspect of our practice. So, you talk about the teacher is very important, and fundamentally, yes, the teacher is absolutely important, and our friends are equally as important. Many of the public cases, the koans, the Zen stories, often talk about friends traveling and questioning one another or exploring the Dharma, and our ability to use our teacher that way is a great gift.
You had your hand. Did you want to say something?
I did before. It's kind of fast.
it kind of sounds like one of the really neat things about the Bodhisattvas is how there's sometimes that aspect of being very unexpected.
Mm.
But it's almost like they're hiding in plain sight, which is kind of an interesting thing. And It's just neat how there are really so many around us at that little unexpected moment. I mean, it could be just that hand that shows up to help catch the casserole.
Yeah.
When you need a hand to catch the casserole. And then goes from there.
And one of the qualities of bodhisattvas are skillful means, mm-hmm. meaning that they use, like in the story yesterday, the fishmonger, the woman who used her beauty to encourage the study of the Dharma. Bodhisattvas use our own desires to bring us here, or catch our attention. And it's the great gift of bodhisattvas.
It seems like there's a quality of the bodhisattvas that we're talking about is that they serve as bodhisattvas for some, or they have limited application, let's say. Santa Claus being a chief one. I thought that was interesting that the good qualities that you mentioned are wonderful, but there's often the negative qualities that we associate with Santa Claus being relying too much on consumerism, transferring, you know, we can go on and on about that kind of stuff. And those would be things that take you out of the moment. But that doesn't do away with the first thing either. It just, right. It exists simultaneously. And I actually find that very encouraging, thinking mm-hmm. of my own life, where there's my good qualities exist at the same time as my bad.
Yes.
That's
And they don't negate your good qualities.
Right.
And our good qualities don't save us from bad qualities. You know, we're not, the salvation is not at hand. And yet, every moment we have choices.
As I'm thinking about this, I'm thinking of all of the moments in my life where I had to take a step back after the fact and say, you know, that person really didn't need to do that. Or they didn't need to go out of their way. They didn't need to, you know, help other people. And, you know, a lot of ways and a lot of situations that I've seen, if I were in their shoes at that moment in my life, I wouldn't have.
Mm.
But, of course, it's very inspiring when you see somebody who puts himself out on a limb or does something just purely for other people, could have walked by and not paid attention. Mm-hmm. And I think those moments, those people in those moments, they have many qualities of bodhisattvas. And I just, you know, until we had this discussion today, I hadn't seen that. A lot of people have a feeling of, well, you know, these things apply to Buddhists.
Yeah.
And I haven't really thought much about expanding that beyond. You had mentioned teachers, and teaching is one of the most, especially high school teachers, the circumstances they have to teach under are just absolutely ridiculous. The pay is terrible. They're underappreciated. And yet for some of them, they do it because somebody did it for them and because they're passing it forward.
Mm-hmm.
The more I think about it, the more I'm seeing instances of that where, you know, wow, this has been all around me the whole time, and I just haven't seen it.
Well, I think, too, like animal companions,
mm-hmm.
dogs and cats, and maybe you're not feeling so hot, and you have a bird, and the bird starts singing. Or you can lean against a tree. Or I think about, you know, I've said this before, but like on Lake Drive, how busy and noisy it is, and those majestic trees, they're always there, and they absorb the noise, and they shade us, and they're ever beautiful
mm-hmm.
and non-complaining. I mean, so much of nature, I mean, our Lake Michigan, so incredibly beautiful, non-complaining no matter what we do. Do you know? The sun pouring her full of diamonds when he shines. I mean, it just, all around us, it's incredible to me what a world of bodhisattvas. But again, we always think about people. Everything is humans. And it's so little of our lives, really. I mean, the holy breath within us, our ears, our noses, our eyes, that we can encompass this miraculous world, you know?
One thing that I feel is the most wonderful thing about Buddhism is compassion. You know, just to see how this is Emmy's friend, Peter's friend, and Peter is still teaching. You know, he instantly goes into this black community and he has his kids who have the potential to be the worst SOBs in the world. But he just is there with them and he goes every day and he's with these kids and I think about it sometimes, you know, and it's I think about my ex-wife and she taught in a school, just the north side of the street, were middle class black people. And the south side of the street was ghetto, straight up ghetto. And so it'd be 10:30 at night, and she's not home. Mm. So you first, you know, you think, damn. So then maybe 10:45 she comes in. Hey, where you been? You know? I was worried about you. Oh, I was in the projects, and these kids saw me. They said, "Miss Sherry, what are you doing over here?" You know, well, I got to go over here and see Jerome's mother. So, and she would go to her and she knocked on the door. She said, "Jerome's mother would come. Hi, Miss Sherry. You know, what are you doing here this time of night?" But this woman would be out there with these kids. Mm. And then in July, she'd be working on lesson plans so that she could bring the kids in her class. You know, those who are slow, you know, she tried to bring them up, you know, a little bit. And then the kids who were smarter, she tried to keep them going so they wouldn't be bored. Mm-hmm. You know, and then she keep working with these kids, these down there, and she keep working with them till all of a sudden they're all on the same level. Mm-hmm. You know, and I told her, I said, I don't know how you do it. I said, you scare me to death. Mm-hmm. You know, but there you are. You know, and my wife was a, can't explain it any other way, she was just a pompous ass. she just, and I was aroused about. so it was, you know, it didn't work.
No.
But she, you know, she has so much compassion for these kids, and I think about Peter sometimes, you know, that, how he, you know, how he's working hard with these kids, you know. And I appreciate it.
There's a famous line from Rinzai, and I think it's something like, where I sit or something like that, there's not a single thing to dislike. And I heard that line a little while ago, and it's really hard for me because, well, for one, there's quite a few things to dislike, but even more abstractly with the notion of the Bodhisattva helping. It seemed like helping requires differentiation between things that are good or things that are bad, things that require help, things that don't require help. And that seems to exist apart from the there's not a thing to dislike. And I'm wondering, I guess there's just these two, I see them as, I don't understand how to make these two things go together. The awareness of what is, regardless of its qualities,
mm-hmm.
and the non-judgmental mind that seems to be praised of that, and also the action for helping in the world, which seems to rely upon a judgmental mind.
Our faith offers us a paradox, the absolute and the relative, or there's all different ways that this dichotomy is labeled. But essentially, the idea that everything is perfect. I mean, if we look out, you know, terrible tragedies and heroic acts, and everything's perfect, and our lives are perfect. They are perfect expressions of causes and conditions. That nothing exists independently, right? We all have sort of a common grasp of the idea of emptiness, that nothing exists separate from the causes and conditions that bring it into existence. And so everything that exists is a perfect expression of the causes and conditions in which brings it into existence. And so we have this absolute world, which is absolutely fine. And then we have the relative world of, I have to breathe my next breath, and I have to eat, and I have to have shelter from the, you know, weather, and this world of differentiation, where horrible social injustices occur, and great examples of compassionate action occur, and we act, and and I would suggest that bodhisattvas actually don't help. They actually be. And in their being, provide examples for us.
Mm-hmm.
But it's easy to get caught into the, you know, and I was going to actually use an example. There was the police officer in New York who bought the shoes for a homeless guy with the no shoes or something a few years ago, right? And so that's the action of helping someone, you know, overtly. But bodhisattvas, for the most part, simply are who they are. And by their very simple being, remind us or bring us into the present moment, or, you know, bring forth those qualities of the Dharma that seem useful to us in the moment. But one, I think a deep experience that comes in the maturing of our practice is seeing experiencing the dichotomy of the relative and the absolute, and having the space to embrace both, or that both exist immediately at the same time, in the same moment, in the same place, that the judgment of I like, I don't like, or good or bad occur in the same moment as the absolute perfection of their expression of the Dharma or of thusness. And and until that happens, you know, we struggle with, you know, being in the relative or being in the absolute, and, you know, it's hard, and it's jarring sometimes, the flipping back and forth, you know, oh, I see, you know, this is what the teacher is teaching, oh, I get that, or I get the story, or I get the experience, and, oh, but, you know, I have to go to the bathroom, and, you know, that's unpleasant or whatever it is, you know, or I, you know, my grandmother is ill and has Alzheimer's and, you know, just how can that, or horrible type of things like, you know, social injustice or the pain of pancreatic cancer or, you know, how can that be perfect that someone is living with such a horrific thing? You know, the kind of questions that call in, that people of deistic faith, you know, call into doubt of the existence of God kinds of experiences. How can the Holocaust be, you know, perfect? Yeah, so at some point in our practice, we get some taste of that there, that we can hold the absolute dichotomy of it, that there's a place in our practice that that occurs.
Sensei?
Yeah.
I don't want to pick up this thing, old thing, but you've done it. You touched on something that has been bothering me about Buddhism for years, and nobody is giving me the answer. A bodhisattva is said to save all sentient beings.
Mm-hmm.
But then, in the next paragraph, there are no sentient beings to be saved.
Mm-hmm.
So how do you deal with this? These dichotomies that are prevalent throughout Buddhist scriptures.
Right. So I will not give you an answer, but I'll give you an answer that isn't useful. The answer that isn't useful is that it's a trick. Right? It's a trick. It is the... if you read Nagarjuna, who was one of our ancestors, he was a master of logic, and his much of his teachings were, if A is B and B is C, therefore A is C, right? The logic equation, and I'm not very good at it. But so the idea that bodhisattvas save all beings, and there are no beings to save, therefore bodhisattvas save no beings. But look around, there's all kinds of beings, right? Trees and grass and birds and people and you know, rocks and rivers and all kinds of beings. So who are they saving? Right? So that presentation is meant to cause you to bind your mind in a kind of knot that is unreleasable. And the more you think about it, the tighter the knot becomes. I don't know if you ever like had to separate fish line, you know, you go out and you know, your fish line gets all caught up and you pull on one and it just gets worse and worse as you play with it until you finally get out the knife and cut the damn thing, right? That's what this argument is to make. The idea of the absolute and the relative, or, you know, there's beings to save and then there are no beings, so therefore what beings are we saving, is an argument meant to bind our mind into a knot that's unreleasable until we experience some intuitive or awakening or kensho or some experience that we get the space to see beyond this knot. So it's not very helpful, but it... But that's the reason for many of these negativisms. Dogen's full of them. You read Dogen, you know, there's this and there's, and this doesn't exist, therefore, you know, we do this. You know, he loves writing that stuff. And and many of the ancestors like that stuff.
That's why I have such a hard time.
Yeah.
I mean, I just can't. I can fathom it.
But it's to challenge us to challenge. So you've had some great teachers, Tozan, Tonin, and a teacher's job is to take away what you think is true, right? is to keep upsetting your sense of stability. And that's what Dogen does. I mean, he's, you know, the reality is this, but it's not this.
Could I ask one more thing?
No, I'm not saying this word through. I'm through.
No, I mean about your question. I don't know if this is helpful, but I've been working on a class that I was teaching, and we read a lot of Dogen and things that sound similar. And it would seem to me that a problem with saying that bodhisattvas save all sentient beings is then if you just left it at that, then there would be things called sentient beings, which, since a basic concept of Buddhism is emptiness, there are no stable anythings, then there can't be stable sentient beings to save. So you also need the phrase, save no sentient beings, so that you don't hold on to the notion that there are stable sentient beings.
That I'm going to do something.
Right. Right. So you need both. And this is similar to Dogen's statement of... it's in the beginning of the Genjo Koan opens up, like, there is Buddha nature, and then there is Mu Buddha nature, which is no Buddha nature. And
he does a bunch of negations.
Right, all the time. Like, every time he mentions Buddha nature, it's both, there's Buddha nature and there's no Buddha nature. Right. And I think the point there is, and I could be wrong, this is just the only thing that I've been able to make sense of, and I'd be curious for other people's opinions about this, that if you... The danger of saying that there is Buddha nature is that if you leave it at that, it makes Buddha nature sound like something like a soul. Like there's something inside of you that is Buddha nature, and if you sit a lot and do other things, you can get that away and you can touch into the Buddha nature thing which is underneath of you. But the Mu Buddha nature, the no Buddha nature, is to suggest that that's not how that works. That it is just that which is.
So you know, which is Buddha nature?
That which is Buddha nature.
Yeah.
Right, right. So I think...
If there was no Buddha nature, man, I would find me another religion.
Right.
After all this 30 years, talking about Buddha nature? No way. You said no? I'm gone from here.
When we walk in Kinhen or any other walking, it is a process of continuous but graceful, hopefully, at least functional, falling and catching ourselves in relation to gravity. We don't have any choice about gravity, but we do have a choice about where we move if we're lucky. And how we move. And after sitting on a cushion for a certain extended period of time, we know we better get up and move and do something. So the sitting part is one thing, but the actual doing, the bodhisattva stuff, involves motion, involves choice, if you're lucky, involves the whole gift that each individual has in terms of style of locomotion, moving in the first place, but it is always in relation to gravity and it is always falling and catching oneself. And so to get anything done, to do anything, permanent or not, I mean, that's kind of moot. It's the falling and catching with skillful, with choice that is helpful, and using whatever skillful combination we can to walk, to move, to fall and catch ourselves against gravity. Sometimes gravity wins, and then we get to pick ourselves back up again, or we don't. But the main points of Buddhism keep floating to the surface, kind of like when I'm cooking something and there are elements that want to float to the top. And it seems to me that over all these readings and all these purposes and all these things and all these conflicts, and certain things keep floating to the top. And those are the things that that involve... well, I think the whole point of things here, I went sideways a little bit. The whole point that I wanted to think about was that the bodhisattva part is the walking and the moving part, and the sitting part, whatever happens there, possibly enables that to be a good thing. And that's a judgment. I'm just going to jump right out and say it. Mm-hmm. Something of benefit to beings.
What's your name again, please?
Ryuzen.
Ryuzen?
Yeah, Ryuzen. My world name, you know, name out in the world is Robbie.
Okay. Maybe we'll call you Ryuzen.
I'd like that.
What does Ryuzen mean?
Ryu is a dragon, and Zen is the study of sitting meditation. Yeah, Zen. Zazen. Zen.
You like us?
Like you?
Not me personally, us.
Us? Yeah, yeah, I like Milwaukee Zen Center.
You know, you have to. I've been here. Right here in this building.
Yeah.
30 years. 25.
You're very lucky.
I was gone fat. And, you know, this is not easy.
No.
This is not easy, and when you have these teachers who come through here and they give you a smattering of goodness, and then you get these authors who are writing a smattering of goodness, you know, and you're trying your best, you know, you're trying your best to put, you know, two and two together, it's pretty hard sometimes, and if you don't have a good teacher, you're not going anywhere. You have to have a good teacher, and
well, you should be very grateful for the teachers you've been having.
Maybe.
It seems like you are.
Maybe.
Let's, four vowels, right?
Yeah.
Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to